I'm Jack Ledbetter, and this is some poems by Robert Frost. If that fridge stays in the low mode, when that thing kicks on, of course, it gets louder, and then we're in for it. I'd like to do Robert Frost up here because it seems to me that people appreciate, love Robert Frost, maybe more than most poets. Longfellow is popular, sometimes Edgar Allan Poe, more for his stories though. Who else? Robert Service, maybe? Emily Dickinson? Some people, they read a lot, T.S. Eliot and some others. But I think, generally speaking, Robert Frost cuts across lines. Academicians like Frost, people who don't like academicians like Frost, academicians who don't like other academicians like Frost. I found that out to my great sorrow when as a graduate student at the University of Nebraska. Oh, this is a small digression, which has nothing to do with Robert Frost. Well, a little bit. One of the people on my committee despised another person on my committee, but the thing they had in common was Robert Frost. That was an interesting year for me, because they wouldn't speak to each other. They pretended that the other wasn't there, and they always went to me as a third person. He said, Mr. Ledbetter, you might tell Dr. So-and-so that he's full of hot air. And then, Mr. Ledbetter, would you please? But they both liked Robert Frost. That didn't keep them hating each other, so it shows you something about the efficacy of verse, I guess. Robert Frost, as you may know, won the Pulitzer Prize 4 times, maybe 5 times, I've forgotten which, I think 4 or 5, more than any other poet. Should have won the Nobel Prize, but didn't, which tells you something about prizes. Lived in New Hampshire, Vermont, taught at Amherst for years, lived in Massachusetts for a long time, and finally got a summer home in Florida. Anybody in Florida? I've never been to Florida. I've always wanted to go down. I made a trek once in the East Coast and found all his farms. I made a point to going through Vermont, New Hampshire, knocking on doors and saying, is this where Robert Frost lived? Pulled into one little town in Vermont, and I thought I had the South Shaftesbury, and I thought I had the right place, and I couldn't find the house. I thought there'd be a big mansion or a big sign, this is it or something. Nothing. So I went into this little butcher shop, little grocery store really on the street there. And I said to the fellow, I said, can you tell me where Robert Frost's house is? And he looked at me, he says, who? I said, Robert Frost. He thought for a minute. He said, I don't think we have a Robert Frost here, do we? I said, well, he's dead. He said, why do you want to see him? And I said, no, he's Robert Frost, the poet. He's all the poet. He said, Harry, can you come in here? And Harry the butcher came out wiping his bloody hands on his apron and says, yeah. And he says, you know where Robert Frost's place is? And he says, he's dead. I said, I know he's dead. I said, he said, why do you want to see him? I heard it twice. I said, I'm just looking for his house. So he finally pointed out, and in a typical New England way, you go past the third sycamore. No, make that fourth sycamore. No, that's the second sycamore. Then you turn right, and you go over the covered bridge, and you turn left at the hollow stump, and you just follow that around a while. And it's one of those lanes up there. So they had... thankfully, it wasn't the big Eat at Joe's sign or neon kind of things or plastic Tupperware. It was just there, and the farm had been bought by an artist and all that sort of thing. So it was good to do that. Once in New Hampshire and outside of Franconia, I finally found his house and knocked on the door and knocked and waited. The lady finally came to the door. She had a scrapbook in her hand. She, without saying anything or asking, she opened it up and without even looking at it. She had done that so many times. She said, this is Robert Frost's last few years. This is his wife. What's her name? I forgot. Miriam? Thought I'd never forget that. His wife. And this is the kids. And this was his dog. And she shut the thing. And this is the addition they built in 24 and shut the door. That was that. Don't come in and have a cup of coffee or let's talk Frost. That was that. So I figured I was not the first tourist to kind of seek out Robert Frost's shrine. He wrote good poems, it seems to me, and that will endure as long as people are interested in poetry and like to read. We could talk about that if you'd like after I read a few poems, but I've got to confess to you right off the bat that I'm not a good one to talk about things like that. I like to read the poems, and if I like them, I say so. If I don't like them, I usually don't say anything. But criticism, I kind of leave for the critics. Sometimes my students get upset about that, especially when they come in loaded with notes and a big fat notebook and intent on picking my brain and finding out all that one could possibly learn about poetry in general and Frost in particular in this semester. And at the end of the semester, I think they're more or less content with coming in and putting their notebook away and just reading poems to each other. Not all of them are content with that, but I think most of them. Frost would be content. Here's Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening. Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. My little horse must think it queer to stop without a farmhouse near, between the woods and frozen lake, the darkest evening of the year. He gives his harness bells a shake to ask if there is some mistake. The only other sounds the sweep of easy wind and downy flake. The woods are lovely, dark, and deep. But I have promises to keep, and miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep. That's a very nice poem. It's anthologized all over the place. People like that poem. I remember coming up here in winter of January of 79, I think it was, with some students, 15 from CL, California Lutheran College at Thousand Oaks, where I teach, and 15 from PLU, Tacoma. And we came over Stevens Pass on a bus. I filled this story, so maybe you've heard it before. You can tune it out. And everybody was asleep, and I was all excited, and I couldn't sleep. And the bus was just kind of waving around on the icy pass. And I looked out the window, and I could barely see, you know how you look at the lights of the bus, you see your own reflection more than anything else. But I could see these boughs heavy with snow out there. And almost bent over the snow. It was dark in there, just gorgeous. And suddenly Frost Line occurred to me. And my buddy Gordon was sitting next to me, teacher. I said, Gordon, he said, what? Is the bus off the road? I said, the woods are lovely, dark and deep. He said, I know, but Frost already said that. No, I didn't want to steal the line. I was, for the first time, I understood what Frost was talking about, it seemed to me, as if I'd never seen snow before. Miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep, and I'm sure you're acquainted with that critical thing, the critic asking why he repeated that line. He said, because I liked it. The critic says, no, that's not it. That's not it at all. Frost says, why isn't it? He's God's a death wish. And then the critic proceeded to tell him about how every line stood for something, the death wish, and then repeating it just was reiterating his need for come sweet death, as Whitman said, and all that. Frost just shook his head. Can't trust critics. What's your favorite Frost poem?
Nothing gold can stay.
Nothing gold can stay. Wonder if I have that in here. You think I would have that in here? That's the danger of asking. You better have it when you ask those kinds of questions. Nothing gold can stay. Okay. Nature's first green is gold, her hardest hue to hold. Her early leaf's a flower, but only so an hour. Then leaf subsides to leaf, so Eden sank to grief. So dawn goes down to day, nothing gold can stay. Nice. How about
A Road Not Taken?
A Road Not Taken. I was just thinking about that. Yeah, this is anthologized all the time too. Every now and then I would run into somebody, either in school or somewhere along the way, you'd say, oh, don't read that, that's anthologized all the time, as if that demeaned it somehow or diminished it. The reason things are anthologized is because they're good. The reason a cliche is a cliche is because it's true, or it's true then anyway. I once had a class at the University of Nebraska where almost every person would come to this prof would say, oh, well, we can't read that, he's done all the time. He had a very skinny book by the time he kept saying that. I said, well, read them anyway. It's not going to hurt him to read them one more time. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both and be one traveler. Long I stood and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth. Then took the other as just as fair and having perhaps the better claim because it was grassy and wanted wear. Though as for that, the passing there had worn them really about the same. And both that morning equally lay in leaves no step had trodden black. Oh, I kept the first for another day. Yet, knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this with a sigh somewhere, ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. There again is that great last line, Frost. You know, he says these things and kind of leaves you wondering. Frost said the poem should begin in delight and end in wisdom. And he does it an awful lot of the time. And those of you who write or have written at one time or another in your life, you know how tough that is. And if you don't know that, I urge you to try it and find out how tough it is. I tell my students that, and they write it down. Do the poem should begin in delight and end in wisdom. That's what Frost said. That doesn't mean every bloody poem has to begin in delight and end in wisdom. I think Frost said it because he knew he could do it. He had tremendous ability. Most poems don't begin in delight, and they don't end in wisdom. A precious few do. A couple by Auden, maybe. A bunch by Shakespeare, of course. And you could go on and on. You know, Tennyson, Browning, the great poets managed to do that. Frost manages to do it an awful lot of the time. But he's so deceptive because of his speech patterns. Somebody, when I was reading Frost up here 10 years ago at Holden Village, I was at a session with Frost. Afterwards, some fellow came up to me and he says, you know, that's not poetry, is it? I said, yeah. Why isn't it? He said, well, it just sounds like conversation to me. I said, well, I wish Frost could hear you say that. We worked all his life to get that. That's, Frost said, poetry should be conversation. Wordsworth said the same thing, should be the speech of men. I think Frost came closer than Wordsworth in that, but both great poets.
What was his educational background?
Oh, he went in and out of a couple of schools. He was valedictorian of his high school class. He was a very bright fellow. He studied Greek and Latin in high school, and went one part of a year to, I just went out. Anybody know? One of the major universities in England. I forgot. No, well, up for in Vermont or New Hampshire, probably New Hampshire. I forgot. Anyway, he went and then dropped out. But he was very bright, so immediately he was made a teacher in an academy. He taught several, but taught all of his life, in and out of teaching all of his life, really. So he was very, very bright, self-taught, and read everything. And
what did he teach?
English.
English.
The classics. He could teach Greek, he could teach Latin.
Uh-huh.
And he and his girlfriend, I can think of her name, Muriel or Miriam or something, were co-valedictorians, as a matter of fact. And she had a very logical head on her shoulders, and Frost was really a romantic. And he wanted to get married right away. And she said, no, we're both going to go to college, and we're going to get jobs, and then we're going to get married. He says, nuts to that, I want to get married right away. And she says, no, and that gave him a hard time. So she went away to college, and he was just anguishing over this. He wanted now. So he wrote some poems and had it privately bound. He wrote, I think there were two or three copies. And he took a train and wherever she was, in New Hampshire, I guess, or Massachusetts, and found the college and found her dormitory room and knocked on the door and said, here I am. And she said, well, are you on spring break? Or he says, no, I quit school. Let's get married tonight. Here's my book of poems. And he'd already given her a ring. And she says, no. And that did it. So he took the ring back, and there was a stove, an old pot, and he picked, you know, the kind you had a little handle, you picked up the top of the lid, and he threw the ring in there, very dramatic. And he slammed the door and walked off, and he got a train, went clear down to Virginia, and walked into the Great Dismal Swamp. I think it's in Virginia, isn't it? The Great Dismal. And he said, I'm going to, and he, all the way, he tore up the book of poems. So there's one down. The other two, or one remaining, is worth a fortune. Anyway, he walked into the swamp, very dramatic. He's like, wow, I'll show her. It's like Tom Sawyer. I remember Huckleberry Finn when they pretended to be drowned. And they're sitting up there all the time listening to their funeral sermon in the church. He says, boy, when they find my body, then she'll be sorry. My little damp curls plastered against my forehead. And he just worked himself up into such a passion. He kept walking and talking and crying and walking and talking. And by daylight, he'd walk clear through the swamp. He hadn't drowned at all. He looked back, he said, well, I'll be damned. So he got back on the train and went back to New England. He tried. They eventually got married and had a very stormy relationship, very stormy life, and had four or five kids, and the kids were stormy lives. It's a, sometime, it's very photogenic old bird, this Robert Frost. You remember pictures of him. Remember that great scene of him reading at Kennedy's inauguration in 1960? Mm-hmm. When the smoke thing shorted out and he couldn't see it, it was too cold and the wind was blowing, he finally gave up and recited another poem. Kennedy liked Frost. Frost liked Kennedy a great deal. There's an interesting story, too. Frost liked people in power. He liked people with power. He liked people who used power. And he wanted to go to the Soviet Union, and he did. Finally, talked to Sherman Adams, remember, of the Kennedy administration, and some others took him over there. And he was, by this time, he was in his 80s, and he was lionized by America and by Russia, where they take poetry more seriously than America. And he said he wanted to be Khrushchev, and they said, well, that's not possible. Nobody meets the great Khrushchev. He said, oh, I do. Tell him Robert Frost is here. And so he, after two weeks traveling in Russia, the word got, Khrushchev said, who is it? He knew all about Robert Frost. So he said, bring him out. So they took him out to his summer home, and it was in a hotel, and Robert Frost got sick. He always suffered from nerves anyway. It could have been indigestion or nerves, whatever. Khrushchev sent his personal doctor over, a woman, to tend to Frost. And as the doctor walked out, Frost was kind of sitting on the bed, hair all rumpled and shoes off and his shirt all out, and Khrushchev walked in the other door. And he sat down and he said, two old warriors like us ought to talk. Mm-hmm. So they sat there and talked for 2 hours. And all the reporters, of course, and all the state people from the State Department who couldn't get next to Khrushchev said, how did he do it? And then Khrushchev, I got to get back to the poetry, but it's sort of an interesting story. Robert Frost was giving a press conference where he made his mistake, I think. One of the things Khrushchev said was that people in America don't have the backbone to stand up for their what they believe, words to that effect. And Frost, instead of waiting till he got back to be debriefed by the president, after all the president gave him permission to go in the country's name, he said that, among other things, to a press conference. And this got back to Kennedy, and Kennedy was furious that Frost hadn't somehow given this information to him, and said he just, America lacks guts or whatever. Shortly thereafter, Kennedy solved, if that's the word, the Cuban Missile Crisis, remember? Kennedy said, take him out of Cuba in 48 hours or else, or whatever it was. It's interesting to wonder how much Kennedy's being angry over that comment by Khrushchev gave him the backbone to do what Khrushchev said he didn't have. You know, you could, no way of knowing if that played into it at all, but it's interesting to surmise. Okay, another Frost. How about Birches? Do you remember Birches? Okay. When I see birches bend to left and right across the lines of straighter, darker trees, I like to think some boy's been swinging them. But swinging doesn't bend them down to stay, as ice storms do. Often you must have seen them loaded with ice a sunny winter morning after a rain. They click upon themselves as the breeze rises and turn many-colored as the stir cracks and crazes their enamel. Soon the sun's warmth makes them shed crystal shells, shattering and avalanching on the snow crust, such heaps of broken glass to sweep away you'd think the inner dome of heaven had fallen. They are dragged to the withered bracken by the load, and they seem not to break, though once they are bowed so low for long, they never right themselves. You may see their trunks arching in the woods years afterwards, trailing their leaves on the ground, like girls on hands and knees that throw their hair before them over their heads to dry in the sun. But I was going to say, when truth broke in with all her matter of fact about the ice storm, I should prefer to have some boy bend them as he went out and in to fetch the cow, some boy too far from town to learn baseball, whose only play was what he found himself, summer or winter, and could play alone. One by one, he subdued his father's trees by writing them down over and over again until he took the stiffness out of them. And not one but hung limp, not one was left for him to conquer. He learned all there was to learn about not launching out too soon and so not carrying the tree away clear to the ground. He always kept his poise to the top branches, climbing carefully with the same pains you use to fill a cup up to the brim and even above the brim. Then he flung outward, feet first, with a swish, kicking his way down through the air to the ground. So was I once myself a swinger of birches, and so I dream of going back to be. It's when I'm weary of considerations and life is too much like a pathless wood where your face burns and tickles with the cobwebs broken across it and one eye is weeping from the twigs having lashed across it open. I'd like to get away from earth a while and then come back to it and begin over. May no fate willfully misunderstand me and half grant what I wish and snatch me away not to return. Earth's the right place for love. I don't know where it's likely to go better. I'd like to go by climbing a birch tree and climb black branches up a snow-white trunk toward heaven till the tree could bear no more, but dipped its top and set me down again. That would be good, both going and coming back. One could do worse than be a swinger of birches. Now, if there was ever an example of a poem that began in delight and ended in wisdom, that's one of them. But sure as heck, you try to do that in your own writing, you just wind up, nothing makes any sense. I have my students imitate a great deal, because that's, or not a great deal, but a fair amount, gets them started anyway, especially when they're reading Hemingway. And they always get two or three in the class, so I can do that. That's just nothing. It's like sea puff runs, it's subject verb. The fishing was good, the sky was good, the air was clean. Those little short lines from The Sun Also Rises. I said, that's right, you could do that. And they go back and they crank something, they come back in and it sounds awful. I said, how does he do that anyway? I said, well, talent, I guess, something to do with it. Sounds easy. How about, let's see, Acquainted with the Night. Do you know that poem? I think that's in here. I have been one acquainted with the night. I have walked out in rain and back in rain. I have outwalked the furthest city light. I have looked down the saddest city lane. I have passed by the watchman on his beat and dropped my eyes, unwilling to explain. I have stood still and stopped the sound of feet when far away an interrupted cry came over houses from another street. But not to call me back or say goodbye. And further still, at an unearthly height, one luminary clock against the sky proclaimed the time was neither wrong nor right. I have been one acquainted with the night.
Could you read Death of a Hired Hand?
Is yes, ma'am. I can.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Death of a Hired Man is... Frost wrote literally everything in verse. Liked rhyme, was awfully good at it, and said, somebody asked him why, typical Frost way, he said, well, there's no such thing as free verse, he said. Writing poetry without rhyme is like playing tennis without a net. It's just sort of a typical Frostian thing. So he didn't write any free verse as far as I know. Everything was rhyme, but he did write good blank verse, and this is a blank verse. Blank verse has five beats per line, but it doesn't rhyme. And it's good for narrative, telling a story. Just to kind of set the stage, try to imagine, if you would, Mary and Warren, two farmers, sitting on the porch, sun gone down, it's dusk, and Warren's just come up from the fields or from the barn, putting the cows to bed or whatever. And Mary said, Silas is here. Silas is the hired man. Silas apparently has been with him before, but never been very reliable. Just when they need him, he's gone. So that's sort of the setting. They're talking on the front porch about the fact that he's back. Mary sat musing on the lamp flame at the table waiting for Warren. When she heard his step, she ran on tiptoe down the darkened passage to meet him in the doorway with the news and put him on his guard. Silas is back. She pushed him outward with her through the door and shut it after her. Be kind, she said. She took the market things from Warren's arms and set them on the porch, then drew him down to sit beside her on the wooden steps. When was I ever anything but kind to him? But I'll not have the fellow back, he said. I told him so last hay, didn't I? If he left then, I said that ended it. What good is he? Who else will harbor him at his age for the little he can do? What help he is, there's no depending on. Off he goes, always when I need him most. He thinks he ought to earn a little pay, enough at least to buy tobacco with, so he won't have to beg and be beholden. All right, I say, I can't afford to pay any fixed wages, though I wish I could. Someone else can, then someone else will have to. I shouldn't mind his bettering himself, if that's what it was. You can be certain when he begins like that, there's someone at him trying to coax him off with pocket money and haying time when any help is scarce. In winter, he comes back to us. I'm done. Shh, not so loud. He'll hear you, Mary said. I want him to. He'll have to, soon or late. He's worn out. He's asleep beside the stove. When I came up from Rose, I found him here huddled against the barn door, fast asleep. A miserable sight, and frightening, too. You needn't smile. I didn't recognize him. I wasn't looking for him. And he's changed. Wait till you see. Where did you say he'd been? He didn't say. I dragged him to the house and gave him tea, tried to make him smoke. I tried to make him talk about his travels. Nothing would do. He just kept nodding off. What did he say? Did he say anything? But little. Anything. Mary, confess, he said he'd come to ditch the meadow for me. Warren. But did he? I just want to know. Of course he did. What would you have him say? Surely you wouldn't grudge the poor old man some humble way to save his self-respect. He added, if you really care to know, he meant to clear the upper pasture, too. That sounds like something you've heard before. Warren, I wish you could have heard the way he jumbled everything. I stopped to look two or three times, he made me feel so queer, to see if he was talking in his sleep. He ran on Harold Wilson. You remember the boy you had in haying 4 years since? He's finished school and teaching in his college. Silas declares you'll have to get him back. He says they too will make a team for work. Between them, they will lay this farm as smooth. The way he mixed that in with other things. He thinks young Wilson a likely lad, though daft on education. You know how they fought all through July under the blazing sun. Silas up on the cart to build the load, Harold alongside to pitch it on. Yes, I took care to keep well out of earshot. Well, those days trouble Silas like a dream. You wouldn't think they would, how some things linger. Harold's young college boy's assurance piqued him. After so many years, he still keeps finding good arguments he sees he might have used. I sympathize. I know just how it feels to think of the right thing to say too late. Harold's associated in his mind with Latin. He asked me what I thought of Harold saying he studied Latin like the violin because he liked it. That an argument. He said he couldn't make the boy believe he could find water with a hazel prong, which showed how much good school had ever done him. He wanted to go over that. But most of all, he thinks that he could have another chance to teach him how to build a load of hay. I know, that's Silas's one accomplishment. He bundles every fork pole in its place and tags and numbers it for future reference so he can find and easily dislodge it in the unloading. Silas does that well. He takes it out in bunches like big birds' nests. You never see him standing on the hay he's trying to lift, straining to lift himself. He thinks if he could teach him that, he'd be some good perhaps to someone in the world. He hates to see a boy the fool of books. Poor Silas. So concerned for other folk, and nothing to look backward to with pride, and nothing to look forward to with hope. So now, never any different. Part of the moon was falling down the west, dragging the whole sky with it to the hills. Its light poured softly in her lap. She saw it and spread her apron to it. She put out her hand among the harp-like morning glory strings, taut with the dew from garden bed to eaves, as if she played unheard some tenderness that wrought on him beside her in the night. Warren, she said. He has come home to die. You needn't be afraid he'll leave you this time. Home, he mocked gently. Yes, what else but home? It all depends on what you mean by home. Of course he's nothing to us any more than was the hound that came a stranger to us out of the woods, worn out upon the trail. Home is the place where when you have to go there, they have to take you in. I should have called it something you somehow haven't to deserve. Warren leaned out, took a step or two, picked up a little stick and brought it back. He broke it in his hand and tossed it by. Silas has better claim on us, you think, than on his brother. 13 little miles, as the road winds, would bring him to his door. Silas has walked that far, no doubt, today. Why doesn't he go there? His brother's rich. A somebody. Director in the bank. He never told us that. We know it, though. I think his brother ought to help, of course. I'll see to that if there's need. He ought have right to take him in, and might be willing to. He may be better than appearances. But have some pity on Silas. Do you think if he had any pride in claiming kin, or anything he looked for from his brother, he'd keep so still about him all this time? I wonder what's between them. I can tell you. Silas is what he is. We wouldn't mind him, but just the kind the kinsfolk can't abide. He never did a thing so very bad. He don't know why he isn't quite as good as anybody. Worthless though he is, he won't be made ashamed to please his brother. I can't think Si ever hurt anyone. No, but he hurt my heart the way he lay and rolled his old head on the sharp-edged chair back. He wouldn't let me put him on the lounge. You must go in and see what you can do. I made the bed up there for him tonight. You'll be surprised at him, how much he's broken. His working days are done, I'm sure of it. I'd not be in a hurry to say that. I haven't been. Go, look, see for yourself. But Warren, please remember how it is. He's come to help you ditch the meadow. He has a plan. You mustn't laugh at it. He may not speak of it, and then he may. I'll sit and see if that small sailing cloud will hit or miss the moon. It hit the moon. Then there were three there, making a dim row. The moon, the little silver cloud, and she. Warren returned, too soon, it seemed to her. Slipped to her side, caught up her hand, and waited. Warren, she questioned. Dead, was all he answered. That's a powerful poem. Mark Van Doren, who wrote, some of you may know Van Doren, Mark Van Doren was alive when Frost was alive, said that nothing is more important than story in poetry. And if that's true, I think Frost, another reason why Frost is so great, that he tells, really, he has something to say. I read an awful lot of poems. I teach creative writing and modern poetry and American literature. So I read a bunch, and I must admit, over the last number of years, I don't get very turned on to poems I pick up in magazines. Either they're obscure and I don't understand them. Well, I'll just stop with that. Why go on? But there's no point in building that case. Frost communicates. I think all the great poets communicate. Even poets that experiment, E.E. Cummings, Gerard Manley Hopkins, who are, and Walt Whitman, who were experimenters, still communicated. Some poets don't particularly want to communicate, like the French symbolist poets, Baudelaire, Mallarmé, Rimbaud, and the boys. They wrote very symbolically, and they probably could care less if we understood. In fact, probably thought they'd fail if we did understand. Well, if that's your bag, that's fine. You take your chances with those kind of poems. They wrote beautiful poems, but some of them were very, very hard to understand. Robert Frost is not the least bit hard to understand. I don't think. But he's not, it's not doggerel either. Now that's a tough thing to do. If you really want to communicate and write about simple things like cows and birch trees and hired men, really common things that we all can resonate with, how do you keep that from being sounding common, if that's the word? That's tough.
Can you expand that thought into other fields too?
Pardon?
You can expand that thought into other fields too, I suppose.
How so?
Well, in drama and so on.
Oh, yeah. Sure. It's hard to communicate. You'd think that'd be the easiest thing in the world, right? We live in an age when we're inundated with words, magazines and TV and me and anybody, all t-shirts that say things, and it just goes on and on. But I don't know how much it communicates. Let me give you another side of Frost. This might give you an idea of another facet of his personality. It's called Provide, Provide. The witch that came, the withered hag, to wash the steps with pail and rag, was once the beauty Abishag, the picture pride of Hollywood. Too many fall from great and good for you to doubt the likelihood. Die early and avoid the fate, or if predestined to die late, make up your mind to die in state. Make the whole stock exchange your own. If need be, occupy a throne where nobody can call you crone. Some have relied on what they knew, others on being simply true. What worked for them might work for you. No memory of having starred atones for later disregard or keeps the end from being hard. Better go down dignified with boughten friendship at your side than none at all. Provide, provide. I mean, even when he was feeling kind of ornery and bitter, he still had a great sense of humor. Another one that shows that particular side of it is a sonnet called Design. You remember that one about the spider and the moth? I found a dimpled spider, fat and white, on a white heelall, holding up a moth like a white piece of rigid satin cloth. Assorted characters of death and blight mixed, ready to begin the morning rite, like the ingredients of a witch's broth. A snowdrop spider, a flower like a frog, and dead wings carried like a paper kite. What had that flower to do with being white, that wayside blue and innocent heelall? What brought the kindred spider to that height, then steered the white moth thither in the night? What but design of darkness to appall, if design govern in a thing so small? Frost had the dark side of the moon to his personality. He's several poems where it's very moody and dark and not at all. I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. Or stopping by woods, or very pastoral, very quiet, mending wall birches. And he's got these kinds of poems too. And why shouldn't he? He's a complete person. He certainly didn't go around singing Hallelujah all the time. So he expressed himself in the darker side. But people don't read the darker side so much. And I'll read this one to you. You can decide where it is. It's called Departmental. An ant on the tablecloth ran into a dormant moth of many times his size. He showed not the least surprise. His business wasn't with such. He gave it scarcely a touch and was off on his duty run. Yet, if he encountered one of the hive's inquiry squad, whose work it is to find out God and the nature of time and space, he would put him onto the case. Ants are a curious race. One crossing with hurried tread the body of one of their dead isn't given a moment's rest, seems not even impressed. But he no doubt reports to any with whom he crosses antennae, and they no doubt report to the higher up at court, then word goes forth in formic, death's come to Jerry McCormick, our selfless forager Jerry. Will the special Janissary, whose office it is to bury the dead of the commissary, go bring him home to his people, lay him in state on a sequel, wrap him for shroud in a petal, embalm him with ichor of nettle, this is the word of your queen. Presently on the scene appears a solemn mortician, and taking formal position, with feelers calmly a twiddle, seizes the dead by the middle, and heaving him high in air, carries him out of there. No one stands round his stare, it is nobody else's affair. It couldn't be called ungentle, but how thoroughly departmental.
You must have been trying to get a building permit.
Yeah. Many times I think his sense of humor saved him from falling into a trap. You know, poets are supposed to be people who feel a lot of emotions. I don't know where that notion came from, but I don't think it's true. And a lot of student writers and people who are beginning writing, they can really turn on them. They open the floodgates of emotion, and it sometimes takes them a while to realize that you've got to somehow objectify the subjective experience. T.S. Eliot called that the objective correlative. You've got to find something that correlates to your passion or your pain and objectify it so people can come and read it. I remember working with a girl this last spring who was writing a poem about the breakup of her romance, and she just wept and cried and bled all over the page. I mean, it was gruesome to read. It was terrible. And I said, God, it's awful. I can't stand it. I can't understand. I said, don't give me all this crying. Everybody's got their own pain. You know, I can show you my scars too. What good is that? I said, when did this happen? She said, last night. I said, what time? She said, oh, I don't know. What difference does it make? I said, well, makes a lot of difference. Tell me what time it happened. She said, well, between sobs. She said, well, it's between 11 and 2. I said, what, did you have him over for dinner? She says, no, I didn't have him over. Did you think I'd have him over for dinner? And she went on, and I said, why, what's he like? And she started talking. The more she talked, the more concrete she got. And I was sort of making little concrete notes. I said, where do you live? She's on an apartment off campus. I said, well, does he drive a pickup or a car? She was really getting exasperated. She was, trying to tell me how badly she felt. I said, well, we'll get to that. So finally I got inside her apartment mentally, and she was telling me, I said, were you watching TV? She says, no, I don't have a television. The stereo was on, or the radio, but the radio went off, the station went off. I said, how do you know it went off? She said, well, I remember it just kind of went, and then it was a little blue dial on the thing, but my stereo was still on. Now, that's a little blue light there. And I said, well, explain. And I said, then she got into the thing. I said, well, we had coffee, we had cigarettes, and he told me he was breaking up. And I got so mad, I stuffed my cigarette in my coffee. It's still sitting there in the sink. And when he left, and my bed was all unwrinkled, and I didn't care, and I went to the, I slammed the door and got the Venetian blinds and wrenched them up to look and watch him take off, and the Venetian blinds. She gave me a dozen concrete images. From that, I could see her passion and have some sense of the agony. But just telling me how bad she felt, you see what I'm getting at? After about 10 or 15 minutes, really, she had some sense of what concrete images do. It's amazing how many young writers, though, think they want to be universal instead of being particular. And it just don't happen. You got to be particular. And if you're particular and honest enough with your images, as Robert Frost is, it becomes universal. It can't help it become universal. It takes them a while to get onto that, but when they do, they're better writers for it. They want to look through the wrong end of the telescope. Okay, how about another poem?
Another one that shows us here is Fire and Ice.
Fire and Ice. Yeah, okay. Fire and ice. Some say the world will end in fire, some say in ice. From what I've tasted of desire, I hold with those who favor fire. But if it had to perish twice, I think I know enough of hate to say that for destruction, ice is also great and would suffice. You almost have to get that one twice. It just in and out, right? It's very good. Dust of Snow is an unusual little poem that nobody reads. Very short. Dust of Snow. The way a crow shook down on me the dust of snow from a hemlock tree has given my heart a change of mood and saved some part of a day I had rued. Nobody uses the word rude anymore either. What else would you like? It's a request time. How about Out, Out? Do you know that poem? It's an unusual poem, Out, Out. It's really a story. And he's got the Out, Out in quotes. So from that, I guess he probably wants us to think about where that quote came from. Probably from Macbeth, Out, Out, Brief Candle. Maybe not. That's what drives my students crazy when I say that maybe not. Because they've just written down Macbeth. Maybe not, cross it out. Well, maybe it is. The buzzsaw snarled and rattled in the yard and made dust and dropped stove-length sticks of wood, sweet-scented stuff when the breeze drew across it. And from there, those that lifted eyes could count five mountain ranges, one behind the other, under the sunset far into Vermont. And the saw snarled and rattled as it ran light or had to bear a load. And nothing happened. Day was all but done. Call it a day, I wish they might have said, to please the boy by giving him the half hour that a boy counts so much when saved from work. His sister stood beside them in her apron to tell them supper. At the word, the saw, as if to prove saws knew what supper meant, leaped out of the boy's hand, or seemed to leap. He must have given the hand. However it was, neither refused the meeting. Hand. The boy's first outcry was a rueful laugh, and he swung toward them, holding up the hand, half in appeal, but half as if to keep the life from spilling. Then the boy saw all, since he was old enough to know, big boy, doing a man's work, or a child at heart. He saw all spoiled. Don't let them cut my hand off, the doctor when he comes. Don't let him, sister. So, but the hand was gone already. The doctor put him in the dark of ether. He lay and puffed his lips out with his breath. And then the watcher at his pulse took fright. No one believed. They listened at his heart. Little, less, nothing. And that ended it. No more to build on there. And they, since they were not the one dead, turned to their affairs. Here's that grim New England attitude, stereotypical grim New England attitude. We should have Tom in here. Have you seen Tom, one of the staffers? He's a maverick. He's got a great bushy beard. He's from New Hampshire. I should have him read this. He's got a great New Hampshire accent. I should ask him if this is what New Hampshire, anybody in New Hampshire, New England? Now that I've got myself in trouble. Let me read you just about one of my very favorite Frost poems. It's called Reluctance. Out through the fields and the woods and over the walls I have wended. I have climbed the hills of view and looked at the world and descended. I have come by the highway home and lo, it is ended. The leaves are all dead on the ground, save those that the oak is keeping to ravel them one by one and let them go scraping and creeping out over the crusted snow when others are sleeping. And the dead leaves lie huddled and still, no longer blown hither and thither. The last lone aster is gone. The flowers of the witch hazel wither. The heart is still aching to seek, but the feet question whither. Ah, when to the heart of man was it ever less than a treason to go with the drift of things, to yield with the grace to reason, and bow and accept the end of a love for a season? I'm going to read that last stanza again, simply because I think it's some of the greatest writing in American poetry. Ah, when to the heart of man was it ever less than a treason to go with the drift of things, to yield with a grace to reason, and bow and accept the end of a love or a season. Well, that's wisdom. Not only wisdom, I mean, he's saying it, he says it in meter. Now try that on your tintype. And he says it in rhyme. I mean, it's got to be very difficult. One time, there's another story, Frost was having dinner with a couple of Jesuit priests, and they were talking about sin and original sin. And the Jesuits, like good old Jesuits, are going at it with charts and graphs and quoting Aristotle and Plato and St. Thomas Aquinas and maybe Thomas Merton and Don Scotus and a whole bunch of other people. And they were waving their hands and going out. And they finally looked at Frost, who was eating his spaghetti and drinking his red wine. And they said, oh, Mr. Frost, what do you think about original sin? Without missing a slurp, he said, it's from their having stood contrasted that good and bad so long have lasted. Went on eating spaghetti. And the two Jesuits stood there and looked at each other. Sat down and started eating their spaghetti. It's from their having stood contrasted that good and bad so long have lasted. Oh, we have time for one more? What time do you have? About 10 to?
10 to.
Got time for a couple more.
Yeah.
Okay. Mending Wall. Do you remember that one?
Oh,
yeah. Let's see if I can find that. That's a good one. That's a good one. Good poem. Mending Wall. Great first line. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that sends the frozen groundswell under it, and spills the upper boulders in the sun, and makes gaps even two can pass abreast. The work of hunters is another thing. I have come after them and made repair where they have left not one stone on a stone, but they would have the rabbit out of hiding to please the yelping dogs. The gaps, I mean, no one has seen them made or heard them made, but at spring mending time we find them there. I let my neighbor know beyond the hill, and on a day we meet to walk the line and set the wall between us once again. We keep the wall between us as we go, to each the boulders that have fallen to each. And some are loaves, and some so nearly balls we have to use a spell to make them balance. Stay where you are until our backs are turning. We wear our fingers rough with handling them. Oh, just another kind of outdoor game, one on a side, it comes to a little more. There where it is we do not need the wall, he is all pine and I am apple orchard. My apple trees will never get across and eat the cones under his pines, I tell him. He only says, good fences make good neighbors. Spring is the mischief in me, and I wonder if I could put a notion in his head. Why do they make good neighbors? Isn't it where there are cows? But here there are no cows. Before I built a wall, I'd ask to know what I was walling in or walling out, and to whom I was like to give offense. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that wants it down. I could say elves to him, but it's not elves exactly, and I'd rather he said it for himself. I see him there bringing a stone grasped firmly to the top, by the top in each hand like an old stone savage armed. He moves in darkness, as it seems to me, not of woods only, in the shade of trees. He will not go behind his father's saying, and he likes having thought of it so well. He says again, good fences make good neighbors. Here's what Frost said about a poem. Like a piece of ice on a hot stove, the poem must ride on its own melting. A poem may be worked over once it is in being, but may not be worried into being. Its most precious quality will remain its having run itself and carried away the poet with it. Read it 100 times, it will forever keep its freshness as a metal keeps its fragrance. It can never lose its sense of a meaning that once unfolded by surprise as it went. Let me close with this one, The Pasture, another one of my favorites, very short. I'm going out to clean the pasture spring. I've only stopped to rake the leaves away and wait to watch the water clear I may. I shan't be gone long, you come too. I'm going out to fetch the little calf that's standing by the mother. It's so young it totters when she licks it with her tongue. I shan't be gone long, you come too. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
If anybody wants to say anything or ask a question, we should have asked. Do you want to ask?
Where do you get information about what background the poem's on? I haven't been able to find that.
Well, that's a good question. You probably have to read a pretty good biography. The best on Frost is a three-volume biography by Lawrence Thompson. And you'll learn more than you ever wanted to know about Robert Frost if you read that. That's probably where you get it. Most of the time, poets don't tell you where it is. Most of the time, it's a composite anyway. But Frost, since he wrote so exclusively about New England, or mostly about New England, you could pretty much... He was born in San Francisco, interestingly enough. His father was a Democratic minor functionary in the Democratic Party and a journalist, and he went to San Francisco. Frost was born there and then went back to New Hampshire after his father died when he was about 8, and he lived in the farm country the rest of his life. Yes, ma'am.
Will we get to hear some of yours?
Are you going to be here Saturday?
Yeah.
I'm giving a reading of my own Saturday.
Okay. One of the things I remember when I was listening to some of his poems, this was in the 50s, there were some records put out by him, was his voice and the way he read them. It just, that was new to me. I never met him or anything like that, but I was just really taken by his almost halting style at times, and his
gravel,
deep, that gravel voice, that
I'm getting, the tailings keep blowing, I get more like Frost every day. Sometimes I play him I like him a great deal too, and sometimes my students say, oh, that's gross, and other college-like things they say. And I say, what do you mean gross? Well, listen to this boy, they're so used to TV actors, somebody with a beautiful, stentorian, mellifluous baritone. I said, how tedious that would be. Let the guy read his poems. Let's hear what Frost sounds like. I don't want to hear what somebody else sounds like reading Frost. And it takes him a while, and T.S. Eliot reading his poetry is just really tedious. They're not used to that. He's very mincing sort of voice. But I like the original. When you can get it, you might as well hear it. Every now and then somebody will do a good job. Who is it in Harris? What's her first name? The actress who did Emily Dickinson.
Julie
Harris. Julie. Yeah, called The Belle of Amherst. Well, it's super when they're really good and they can do it. Ed Begley, remember the character actor Ed Begley?
Yeah.
Reads Walt Whitman better, and he's got a terrible old gravelly voice, but God, Whitman is just super. So occasionally you get an actor who really has appreciation for the words, and they're not trying to emote. The things that drive me up the wall is when you get the actor and they go off and... That's fine for the stage, but I'd like to let the words come out. Frost is a good one.
Evan Williams does some good readings of, what is that drunken English poet?
Dylan Thomas?
Dylan Thomas,
Dylan Thomas is one of my minor gods, along with D.H. Lawrence and Frost and Thoreau and about 49 others. Anything else?
The thought that came to me as you were reading about the death of the hired man, the wisdom of this couple that comes through. And I'm reading Michener's Poland right now, and how he talks about the wisdom of the peasants who have no education at all. The two just clicked in my mind as I heard that profound wisdom that this couple has about about the death of this man.
And who else, what wisdom, when they say home is the place where when you have to go there, they have to take you in.
That really blows you.
That's right.
I didn't know until that then.
Was that original Frost?
Yeah. As far as I know.
I've heard it for years, you know,
yeah.
And mostly as a joke.
Yeah, I know. Yeah,
home is a place you go where they have to take you.
Yeah, they don't know whether that's good or bad.
Sure.